Blog Talk Radio.
Forbidden archaeology, forgotten history, divination, magic, cryptozoology, UFOs, nature, science, and spirit. All this and more right here on the Main Street Universe Radio Network.
Money. That's right. The green stuff. Dollar bills. Notes of promise. As human beings is apparently our destiny, and some would say a sign of our good character, that we master the art of collecting these green notes of promise. In fact, some, or not most of the money we've collected, is money that we might not even ever physically see. For now, our financial transactions are often done with a magnet on a plastic card. This magnetic strip sends energy signals to a computer system, and if the magical numbers are represented and line up in that computer data bank, then the transaction is allowed. It's accepted. But I ask you, and many I guess as well would, what if your skill is not necessarily, or at least at this point in your life, not necessarily one which included as your skill set gathering and the collecting of these magical energy numbers? Numbers backed almost entirely on a collective belief system. The numbers are stored in some computer database somewhere. So what does this database really represent? Does this represent your passion? Does it represent your life's work? So again, I ask, what if you're just unlucky or have bad timing? Or were born into a position where maybe you did not have access to an education on economics? And what does any of this have to do with vampires, somebody might be asking? We're getting to that. Some people may say, and I have met people like this in my life for sure, if you are not able to make the money, then you deserve whatever comes to you, pish posh. So poverty, sickness, death is what you maybe deserve if you're not good at collecting these magical numbers. As a young person coming of age, rich or poor, perhaps more so even rich, a young person hopefully begins to question things. I remember clearly and still carry with me to this very day an idealistic notion that we as human beings can make a far better world for ourselves and for the planet that we live on. It is just like believing in magic. The toughest thing about a magical working is the magician believing in it. This is why I find money fascinating. Money, now more than ever, is little more than energy impulses in a computer. And people believe in this magical number collective, even though nothing but a belief in more of it circulating backs these numbers up. Not since the 1500s has it been backed by gold, some say. So, back to our young idealist. You start to think, can we live on an earth beyond the corruption, beyond the destruction brought on by a consumerist theology, if you will? Can all people be fed, be clothed, be housed? Then our young idealist reaches out to his or her fellow humans. The ideas and concerns are then expressed and are met with doubt, maybe anger, maybe laughter, oftentimes laughter. So now what, our idealist thinks? Well, maybe there is a place you can witness the so-called impossible become the possible. This is where you can escape to work out how can you make miracles happen. Turn to smoke, turn into a bat, fly, and maybe live forever. In the place of dreams, no one is telling you you can't do these things, and all things are possible, and just maybe as within, so without. Can it be that part of the fascination with vampires in our culture is directly linked to our idealistic yearnings for a better world, for humans that believe in their own power rather than doubting it? You're listening and welcome to Main Street Universe, the show and network reminding you that the mysteries and possibilities of the universe are closer to Main Street than you may have ever imagined.
And I can imagine a lot.
And this evening, our guest is Miss Margot Adler, reporter for NPR for a long time, author of Drawing Down the Moon, Heretic Heart, and recently, Vampires Are Us. So join us in our circle as we return with Miss Margot Adler. Welcome to another edition of Main Street Universe, the show reminding you that the mysteries and possibilities of the universe are closer to Main Street than you may have ever imagined. I am Daniel Michael, the founder and co-creator of the Main Street Universe Radio Network, and I'd like to welcome associate producer and co-hostess, Ms. Janice R. White.
Welcome, everybody. Glad to be here.
Janice is as well the host of the World Reggae Party here in Radio Fairfax on local terrestrial old media radio, or whatever they call that stuff over there at FPA.
FPA, Radio Fairfax.
Absolutely. And I'd like to remind everyone that Main Street Universe is in fact a network of 6 shows, starting with this one, Wednesday evenings, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, myself, associate producer Janice R. White, and Brett Hillman, who's not here this evening, he may not be. And we discuss all sorts of issues. We're sort of the eclectic community center show of the network, if you will.
Yes,
and the other
I
shows
agree.
Are the little rooms within the center, if you like to think of it that way. Co-founded by my good friend Kevin Baird. And then on Thursday evenings, well now Thursday daytime, that's right, our one daytime show is Queen Mother Imaku.
Yeah.
With her show Uatau, she discusses the Kemetic African-Egyptian connection.
Very good shows, actually.
Absolutely, with original language prayers and an interesting take on paganism from the African Kemetic tradition. And some people forget that Egypt is, in fact,
Africa. Yeah.
So tune into her 2 p.m. Eastern Time. And then on Fridays, we have Jesse Ann Nichols-George with Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour. Jesse is the author of 4 books, Activating Compassion and its companion workbook, as well as You, Me, Life, Dreams and its companion workbook. 12 midnight, and Jesse is working on some amazing guests, and we've already had so many on the network thus far. We've been so blessed, including this evening. And Jesse and Nichols-George, 12 midnight. And then on Sundays, we have Spiritual Insight with your host, Mr. Darren Boucher, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. All these shows are Eastern Time. That I'm announcing. Darren is a palm and tarot reader at Marie Laveau's House of Voodoo in the magical city of
New Orleans.
New Orleans.
Louisiana, NOLA.
Absolutely. So tune in at 7 p.m. Eastern Time for Darren Bouquet. Then on Mondays, we have our new host, a Vedic astrologer known as Mr. Randy Goldberg.
I know him. Very nice.
Yes, very nice person. And he has, in fact, been on NPR himself, as well as CNN, and has been interviewed by the Washington Post, I believe. So Randy Goldberg, our new addition, at 10 p.m. Eastern Time on Mondays. So tune into that. Very unique perspective by Randy, who lived in India as a monk for a while and then returned back here to the West, and now combines both an Eastern and Western approach, some discussions of Jungian philosophy and other things. So Tuesday evenings, we'd like to welcome our host, Miss Susan Weed, the herbal medicine expert.
Great.
Who discusses...
Great source of herbal medicine.
Absolutely, and we're discussing astragalus right now after coming off of evergreens, and I co-host that one with her, which is a joy because I learn so much, because that was one side of metaphysical practice I wasn't really that schooled in, and I remember talking to our friend, I believe it was Marcy, one of our listeners, I said, I'd like to meet a really good herbalist teacher, and then I come across Susan Weed, and now I co-host the show with her, and I learn a ton of things. So great to have her on board.
Great to have her on board.
10 p.m. Eastern Time, Miss Susan Weed. And that makes up the shows on the Main Street Universe Radio Network, except for Kevin Baird, who's right now on Fridays, but that'll change and rotate, Walking on the Sidewalk in the mornings. So his show is Walking on the Sidewalk, 9 a.m. Eastern Time, until those things change. Right now it's 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and he is the founder, the creator of the Horizon Oracle Cards. You can find out more about him, including some of his artwork, which I have hanging on the wall right now.
I was nice. Thinking that was Kevin.
Absolutely. He calls it Frozen Smoke. It's like cloud staring. Very nice. I think it looks like a luck dragon. If you see that. I know this is radio. I can't really point that out for too long here. But you can find Kevin at www.templeofgaia.com.
Still trying to get World Reggae Party on.
Yes.
And Mary Phelan to come back.
That's right. So we have a few things we're working on to upload as pre-recorded shows from another network. So tonight we're discussing vampires with our guest, Margot Adler. And as I say, instead of me talking about her, I'll have her talk about her. And turning her microphone on right now.
Hello there.
Welcome, Margot.
Hello.
Hi there.
Yes, you have to have the chime.
Sometimes we
have
do the show
the
from
chime.
A recording studio with a whole drum set, so it's actually less obnoxious this evening.
When you were doing your whole money rap,
I
had this very weird memory of my father telling me this extremely odd story, which has nothing to do with vampires, but definitely has to do with money. And I'm still not sure if it's real or apocryphal or completely bogus, but he said if Jesus Christ put a penny in the bank at whatever it was at the time he told me, 5.5% interest, it would be a ball of gold bigger than the sun. Ergo, that's why the capitalist system will never work.
Oh. And I guess that depends on what you find to
the
degree of.
So I have no idea if it's true, but...
That is an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah.
And, of course, now they're not even using gold, so maybe they found a way around the problem. I don't know.
Now they're using bitcoins.
That's right, the new bitcoins.
Right.
Well, Margot, you are an author and a reporter, correspondent, New York correspondent, right, for National Public Radio.
For NPR, yes.
Yes.
And
an author and just coming off a 4-year vampire obsession.
All right.
So,
probably
want to know how I, who really had very little interest in vampires, I probably had read The Interview with a Vampire and The Vampire Lestat by Anne Rice, and I knew Whitley Strieber, and so I'd probably read The Hunger. And I'd seen that great movie, The Hunger, with, Catherine Deneuve and David Bowie and all that. And but I really didn't care. I was more of a science fiction, fantasy kind of reader. And I never, vampires just never did it for me in any way. And I was at actually a pagan gathering in Florida. I was on my way to Florida pagan gathering, and I was in a bookstore. And I kind of needed a trashy novel for the plane, and I bought the first Twilight novel, and I, you know, read it. And actually, T. Thorne Coyle made a lot. She was rooming with me at the festival, and she was joking with me all the time. And she was saying, oh, my God, you're dealing with all these sparkly vampires. They're so silly. They're so ridiculous. And I was sitting in this little cabin and kind of getting obsessed. And then on the way home, I read volume number 2. And then I got home, and it probably would have just ended right there. There would have not had any, you know, that would have been it. And then about 10 days later, my husband, who was in perfect, absolute health, no genetic background, had never smoked, hadn't even taken any drugs as a teenager and as a kid, unlike me, but I mean, he was really, you know, Mr. Perfect Health.
Teenage,
you know?
Life is patent.
Yes, Mr. Perfect Health, you know, and he gets just a form of horrible terminal stomach cancer that basically, I think, mostly you get in Japan by eating the wrong kind of, eating certain kinds of foods and stuff like that, which he never ate. But anyway, he got this cancer, and during the 9 months that he lived and I was sitting at his bedside, while he was asleep, I just was obsessively reading vampire novels to such an extent that 4 years later, I've read 270 vampire novels, which is, people keep on asking me, they say, there are 270, and I say, believe it or not, they're probably somewhere more like 6,000, but anyway, so I read all these vampire novels, and in the beginning, it was clearly a meditation on mortality, you know, it was clearly, oh my God, my husband is dying, what does this mean, you know, do I want to live forever, do I want him to live forever, what would the world be like if we were long lived, and I started thinking about all these science fiction novels like Last and First Men by Olaf Stapleton and all this other stuff, and so that was how it started. But at some point, about 6 months in, I suddenly went, oh, well, that's very nice that all that immortality and mortality stuff is happening and I'm thinking about it, but most of the people I know who are interested in vampires aren't thinking about it at all, so there's clearly some other reason that Hollywood spent $7 billion over the last 2 years for movies and television shows based on vampires. And so I started kind of asking the question, why do vampires have traction in our culture right now? And at that time, I remember coming across this amazing quote by a woman named Nina Auerbach, who had written a book called Our Vampires Ourselves. And she basically said, every age, it needs. And talking to all kinds of historians about this, and, you know, one of them said, well, you know, if you think about Dracula, it was written, you know, 1897. England had the largest ports in the world. There was fear of immigration. There was fear of immigrants getting in. There was fear of disease coming in. And suddenly you have this spike of human bodies basically, you know, in steerage essentially coming over in these boats. And suddenly you're feeling, oh, my God, what is this all about? And so that fear and concern of this monster bringing dirt from a foreign land, that, you know, sort of all wrapped in this notion of what were the needs and concerns of that time. And in 1816, the first vampire story in the English language was written in the same chateau on the same weekend that Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein. And probably you could argue that the fear and concern at that moment was science playing God. So I kept on doing this, and I kept on looking for, well, if that's true, what's happening now? Where are the vampires now? What are they? What are our fears and concerns? And right about that time, I ended up going to California, and I met with this woman who was at the University of the Pacific, and she was teaching a course on vampires, films, and fiction. But she was also a really interesting person because she was a Quaker. And she had a whole Quaker kind of view of life, and she was very into looking at issues of power. And as I talked to her, I realized that she would say things like, well, you know, every good vampire movie worth its salt really asks the same question. And that question is, if we're at the top of the food chain, you know, do we treat human beings as cattle? Or since we were once human, do we treat humans with respect? And that's the same question that everybody asks on every issue. So if you have more money than someone, if you have more status than someone, if you have more power of all kinds and abilities, and et cetera, do you essentially treat the others as lesser? Or do you in fact say, okay, they're part of the whole, and now we try to get everything together so we're more equal, more this, more that. So she said, you know, that's a central, does might make right? That is really the central argument of our time, and vampire movies and films all embody it. So I thought that was pretty interesting. So I was, you know, I was going about my way and still trying to figure out, well, what happens now? Okay, I get all this stuff, but what's happening right now? And then one day I was, I just had this light bulb go off, and it was, the light bulb was this. It was, I put on a piece of paper all the most popular vampires in the last 15 years, the ones that were on television. So, you know, I had the Cullens in Twilight, and I had, you know, Bill and Eric from True Blood, and Damon and Stefan from The Vampire Diaries, and, oh, Mick St. John from, you know, Moonlight, that one season series, and I had Angel and Spike from Buffy, and I had, who's the guy from Tanya Huff novels, this 400-year-old bastard son of King Henry VIII. Anyway, I had him, and I put them all in a line on a piece of paper, and I said, well, what do they have in common? And it was just, I had this, like, light bulb moment where suddenly it was like they're all conflicted. They're all desperate. They all want to actually do the right thing, but they often fail. They are desperately struggling to be moral despite being predators, only they're often failing. And that's exactly who we are. We are desperately struggling to be moral despite being predators, only our blood is oil. And we're sucking the lifeblood out of the planet. So that was like my first insight. And I was like saying, oh, wow, that's kind of interesting. And I was also looking at identity and sex and all kinds of other things. And Anne Rice wrote me this unbelievable email at this very moment in which I had asked her, so why do vampires have traction in our culture, dear Anne? Please answer me. And she answered, well, I really don't know. I have nothing to say, blah, 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 blah. And then after she says all that and then says all these obvious sentences like the vampire represents the outsider and the vampire, this, that, and the other, suddenly she comes out with this sentence. And the sentence is, for teens, their attraction to vampires has to do with the fact that they are desperately seeking a noble path through the hideous passage that Western culture has set up for them. And I started thinking about that sentence, and I started thinking about the Cullens and Twilight having to do high school over and over again. I mean, imagine having to go to your senior prom 5 times. I mean, it was bad enough the first time, right? It was probably
hideous
the first time, you know? You don't want to do that 5 times. So I suddenly, you know, I started thinking about all the passages that teens have to traverse, you know, corporate culture and jock culture and you know, academic pressure and, oh, you know, their parents and how they were very clear-eyed because they saw much better than their parents, in fact, the abuse of power, and they understood power in a way that their parents really didn't. So all these things started coming together, and then I said to myself, the last insight of it all was this. I said, okay, if this vampire that we have created in our time that represents this desperately struggling to be moral but failing predator, when did that start? Where did it come from? Was it first Anne Rice? Was it first, did it go back only to Buffy? And I started going back and back and back and back, and suddenly there I was at Barnabas and Dark Shadows, who was probably, in a way, the first conflicted but, you know, somewhat moral, somewhat murderous vampire. And I said, well, when did that vampire come to be? When, you know, now Barnabas started in 67. He really wasn't called a vampire until 68. Well, what happened in 68? Well, in 1966, Stuart Brand, the founder of the Whole Earth Catalog, was on a rooftop in San Francisco looking stoned out of his tree on marijuana, and he was basically looking at the sun going down and seeing the earth because he was so stoned. He was thinking of something that Buckminster Fuller once said, which was that the root of man's misbehavior is the fact that he thinks that the earth is round and infinite. He thinks the earth is flat and infinite, actually. And so he printed up a political button that said, it was a very interesting button. It said, why have we not seen yet a picture of the whole earth? And he passed these buttons around to NASA, to diplomats, to Marshall McLuhan, to all these people all over the country, Soviet diplomats, American diplomats, and of course, 2 years later, Apollo 8 finally gave us that first photograph, Earth rising, and then a couple of years later, Apollo 17 gave us the blue marble Earth, which is probably the most reproduced photograph in the history of the world. And so suddenly we saw that we were tiny, vulnerable. And while the first moments of that understanding seem to be incredibly positive, we are all brothers, there are no boundaries, the more you think about that little tiny speck of white and blue that the astronauts could cover with their thumb, the minute you think of that seriously, you realize that there's a darker vision, and that darker vision is that we are vulnerable, that we are responsible, that we are complicit, that in fact it is our responsibility, the Earth. And so the central argument that I've spent a ridiculous amount of time telling you about is that I think when our views about the Earth changed and our understanding of who we were on the planet changed, I think that was the moment that our vampires changed.
And I wanted to make a point there, and it's a very good point that you make, in comparing it to how we view humanity and the Earth as a whole. That's why in part of my introduction, though at first it might have sounded confusing to people, I was talking about money and the money system. And part of the allure of being attracted to vampires, just like any other kind of magical being or supernatural being or maybe superheroes, like when you're a kid, is stepping away from the harsh, cold reality you're in. And so I thought it was very interesting in your speech that you gave for the Vampires Are Us at that church, when you said sometimes when society has let go of divine and purposeful things, you look in the trash when you were comparing. So I looked into these trashy novels, and I found something interesting and found an interesting connection. I wonder if you could comment
exactly
on that. Is it just escapism, or is there value in these types of books?
I think that there's a lot of value, just like there is in science fiction. Not in all of them. There were probably 20 books that I wanted to throw against the wall and just thought, oh, my God, there's, like, absolutely no redeeming. And most of them, I have to confess, were romances and with really formulaic sex scenes and kind of like four or five scenes in each novel of which it was kind of, he filled me, you know, and all that kind of stuff, and you want to just throw up, you know, really, really bad sex scenes. And the funny part about that is that if you look at some of the great vampire novels, there's no genital sex. You know, Anne Rice, there's blood exchange, but there's no genital sex. Anne Quinn Yarbrough, there's no genital sex with St. Count Germain, you know, the Count St. Germain. So that all these sort of modern, gothic, you know, beautiful, buxom ladies with the perfect, you know, dark vampire creature, et cetera, you know, some of them are all kind of ridiculous.
No.
And so I don't think all of them are great. But getting back to your money idea, I think that it's not a coincidence that Marx, that Engels, that Voltaire, that a whole bunch of people, you know, going way back to the 18th century and even before, used vampire in the sense of the person that preys upon the public, that preys upon money, that preys, you know, that there's this notion of the vampire banker that Occupy Wall Street used and stuff like that. So I think that actually there's been this really interesting connection between money and power and stuff like that. But getting to the question of the books and whether they're worth anything, some of them are really great. I mean, I would say, you know, I have a section in my book in which in my book, which is called Vampires Are Us, and I have a section all on the 270 novels, and I have a whole essay on genre and why genre in this culture is dissed, and I use a lot of Ursula K. Le Guin because she's so brilliant, and, you know, and she talks about genre and fantasy, and she talks about why people in this culture are so afraid of fantasy. And she says the reason people are so afraid of fantasy is that it's the same reason, her essay is called Why People Are Afraid of Dragons. And she basically ends up saying people are afraid of dragons and they are afraid of fantasy because way down deep they're afraid of freedom.
Because, yeah, the dream world is a very free place.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a very powerful lucid dreamer, for example. So it is a very, it can either be a horrifying nightmare that seems 100% real, or it can be something you take control of. And I saw we had a caller there, and I think it was our friend Kevin. If you're listening, feel free to call back. So maybe he had a comment over there. I'm not standing right at the computer, but I'll keep an eye on the call queue. And you mentioned T. Thorne Coyle. She's been a guest on our show,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, she's been a guest.
And you mentioned treating, and I think this is an important thing, how do you treat those that are less powerful than you? Like,
mm-hmm.
our competition here is Pagans Tonight, and I am a far superior talk show host to them. And I treat them amazingly well. Just playing. They're friends of mine. I'm just playing. But they are on right now in competition with us.
Yeah.
But Janice, in fact, I think it's Selena Fox. I can't really say anything.
We love Selena. So.
But
I love Selena. I love Selena so much. You know that I was the minister at her wedding and she was the minister at mine.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
didn't
very
know that.
Cool. Did not know that.
It was very cool. And we room together at Pantheacon every year.
Oh.
So that's going to be in a week. We can't wait.
Yes, it will be in a week.
Mm-hmm.
We have some of her Circle Sanctuary folks here. They just seem like a solid organization, one of the most solid.
I'm one of them.
Yeah, Janice is actually in that program as well.
Yeah.
And I think Janice had a question
great.
To Margo.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking that vampires would classify our fear of death because vampire
mm-hmm.
is mortal, and there's only really two ways to kill one. One, stake through the heart, and the second, sunlight. Because all those things about crosses and holy water and garlic, twilight and true blood and other things have kind of demystified them.
That part is diminished in the modern vampire novel.
Right. So there's really only two ways of doing it. Like I said, sunlight and a stake through the heart. So
right,
I was
and fire in some places. Fire often.
Chopping
yeah.
the head off.
Oh, chopping the head off, yeah. That's
those
a lot of modern runs, yeah. Chop the head off.
Right.
So I was
right.
thinking
the fear of dying. So how do you feel about that question?
Oh, I think it's a big one. I think that's where I started out. I mean, my husband was, I think before I met my husband, we had been together like for 35 years. Not, we were only married for 22, but we were together for 35 years. And we had each read probably 1,000 science fiction novels. And he was someone who wanted to live forever. There's no question about it. He came from a family. He was the oldest of four. And his parents were killed in a plane crash when he was 16. And it devastated his life. And he, I think he thought death was the most horrible thing that could happen. I mean, he really, you know, he didn't really have any kind of positive thing about it. And so he was constantly, he was a health nut and a runner and, you know, doing everything, you know, sort of perfectly and looking up aging research and all the kinds of crazy supplements people were taking and stuff like that. And he was really into all of that. And as I even think that at our first date, I think we even, it was like going out, it was like a Woody Allen movie almost, you know, where you're sitting there and we were both sort of dealing with, I was dealing with the death of my mother and he was dealing with death. It was like this lugubrious, really depressing Chinese restaurant scene for first date. It was really weird. But we both, you know, had this thing. I think we both really wanted to, well, I think at first I thought our attitudes were similar. But as time went on, I realized I had a much more pagan sort of earth-centered view of death. And so that his was just that it was horrible and, you know, there was nothing else. And mine was, you know, well, maybe we only return to the elements and we become earth and air and fire and water. And I remember that I had read Barbara Walker in one of her books, in her book on the I Ching, had this incredibly interesting saying that where the ancient elements came from. Now, she didn't have a single footnote on this, so who knows how scholarly true any of this is, but it was just a great idea that the way the ancients went to their death was the way that we began to understand the elements. So, for example, you were either, you know, you were burned on the pyre, you were left for carrion, you know, in the air, you were buried in the earth, and you were perhaps taken out and, you know, buried at sea. And so that the way you went to your death was sort of the way of first thinking of the most primitive people first thought of the elements. So I was that was fascinating. And I kind of thought, well, if that's the way it ends for me, that's okay. And so we had, you know, very, very different. He really wanted to push the edge of the envelope and, you know, do every kind of anti-aging research and take every supplement in creation. Maybe he even shortened his life that way. And I was much a little more laissez-faire.
Yeah. And, Margo, we do have a caller.
And okay.
Go ahead and take it. I think this is a friendly caller. We do have
okay.
Degrees of
freedom. Hello.
Hello, it's Kevin.
Welcome.
It's
you're on the air,
how you doing?
Kevin.
Yep. Daniel, let her know who I am.
This is Kevin Baird. I was putting the phone down. Sorry. This is Kevin Baird, and he's the host of our Friday morning show right now, Walking on the Sidewalk. And he created the Oracle deck, from which it's become my main deck that I actually read from now, as well as the traditional era. But and an artist as well. I got some of his art on the wall here.
Right.
And he co-created this little network with me, actually, Main Street Universe, and he helped come up with the name.
Oh, that's great.
Right, but I was inspired by your, you know, your comments about suffering with, you know, people with death and everything, and you commented about Buckminster Fuller. I hail from the university. I'm in Carbondale, Illinois, where he invented his geodesic dome. I don't know if
you're
savvy on that. Yes.
Oh, really?
So it's
I
like
met
tying
him a couple of times.
Yeah, it's tying us all together. It's like, you know, and they have it as like a big, like, sort of like some kind of honorarium that they have, like this big geodesic sanctuary where he built this dome and that people come up to it and look at it and are amazed by what he does and that kind of stuff and what he did and inspired people. So we're sort of like the center of some universe that people are inspired by. But I wanted to say that I'm inspired by your, you know, pursuit about vampirism and, you know, the predatory nature of vampires and how they survive on the minions, basically, that are around them. And sometimes the minions give up of themselves to help the vampires be better because somehow the vampires empower the minions or their minions, if you see what I'm saying. Does that make sense?
It might. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Because, like if you look at, like, there was one, like, his Vampire Diaries, I think, to where there was this
like the TV show, you mean, with, like, Stefan and Damon and Elena and all that?
Yeah. And that there was this, like, servitude person who was really helping the vampire because he felt like there was value coming from his existence or something like that, and maybe there was or something, and that there was some kind of quality that was added. So some people feel vampires are helpful, and we know that there are psychic vampires that are out there.
Absolutely. I'll tell you a really funny story. So
go ahead.
I went to Transylvania, and last year, not really to do with vampires, although it was lovely that I did was there.
Mm-hmm.
But I basically went to be part of the second annual covenant, Women's Covenant of Unitarian Universalist Pagans.
Amazing.
And it turns out, you probably don't know this, because I certainly didn't know this, that Transylvania is where Unitarianism started. It was one of those Protestant protest movements, and in 15-something-something, it's when it started.
Mm-hmm.
And there are 110 Unitarian churches, most of them, all of them, pretty much in the Hungarian-speaking areas of Transylvania. So I went to this conference, which was really fun, and there were about 100 Europeans and about 150 of these Transylvanian women, many of whom were kind of peasant women, you know, farmers' wives and other kinds of, you know, this, that, and the other. And you know, when you're in an academic conference, a normal academic conference, people, you know, raise their hands and this, that, and the other. And all the Europeans were raising their hands and asking questions. And, of course, and none of the Transylvanian women were saying bupkis at all. They were just sort of quiet in the back. So at one point I gave my vampire, you know, talk. And at the very end, and these were being simultaneously translated in Hungarian and English. So at the very end, a woman stepped up to the microphone and asked me, did I think vampires were real? And I said, you know, quite frankly, while there are a tiny, small number of people who actually go around drinking blood and this, that, and the other, and who knows, you know, how
right.
serious that is, whatever. I said, in general, I don't believe that there are the blood-sucking kind, but I think we've all had the experience of going into a room where the energy was completely sucked out by somebody. I said, I'm sure you've had some kind of experience like that. And after I said that, all these Transylvanian women came up to me at the end and said things like, oh, yes, my father is such a vampire. And, oh, yes, my husband is such a vampire. Right? And it was like the most amazing thing. And the very end, and it's still a fairly patriarchal society there, even though.
You enabled them.
I enabled them. And at the very end, the Transylvanian women were supposed to give a little cup, a little present, a little folk kind of thing to women that they, you know, valued who were European or whatever. And I ended up with like 7 of these cups. And I'm convinced it all had to do with the fact that I said that at that lecture.
So I have a question. Do you think you are a vampire?
No. I mean, well, what do you, in fantasy, but not in reality. I've had many vampire fantasies. Yeah.
So
definitely.
To some extent, would
I've
you...
tried to write vampire fan fiction. Mm-hmm. It was terrible.
Yeah. So
I was really bad at it.
So what I'm saying is like, okay, let's say you're in a dialogue with somebody and that they are listening to what you are telling them and that you spend an hour explaining to them this thing that they want to know more about and that they sit there basically or on the phone nodding their head, agreeing with what it is that you are saying. Is that maybe a current era kind of psychic or a vampiric, really, is the word I guess I want to use, kind of condition?
I think only if you feel that you're being drained of energy.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I mean, if you feel that you're giving energy and you're getting back and you know, it's so interesting the different times that when you, you know, you can be teaching for 10 hours doing something and yet you feel you're totally replenished at the end. And
yeah.
then you can do another kind of thing and suddenly you're not replenished at all. So I think it really depends.
Right.
By the way, I should say that I have no idea if you have listeners in California.
Yes,
we have them.
I want to mention that for you, by the way, Margo.
Yes.
Margo will be speaking at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, California, Monday, February 10th at noon, and I as well will add it to the link.
We'll add it to the link as well.
To the show link, because a lot of times we get a lot more even archive listens than when it is live. So I will add that to the link. I added where to buy your book directly. And I do see we're coming up. We're going to take a short break here and then come back in just a couple minutes. We have about 15 minutes left. And I see Darren Bouquet was in the queue, he's dropped out. But we're going to take a brief song break and come right back.
Thank you, Miss Margo.
It's from our friends Before Moonlit Nights, which is Woven Green.
Thank you.
Before moonlit nights, an infant cries in the great void of silence. Before we knew time, a miracle spawned the dawn.
Welcome back. This is Daniel Michael, and you're listening to Main Street Universe with myself and hostess Janice R. White.
Hello, everybody.
And we're talking with associate producer Janice R. White, and we're talking to Margo Adler. I'm going to go ahead and bring her microphone back on. Welcome back, Margo.
Welcome back, Margo.
Hi, good to be back.
And I'll go ahead and turn Kevin's mic back on, too. And our reader from calling from the magical city of New Orleans is here, by the way, Mr. Darren Bouquet. But before we get to him, I want you to plug anything you would like to plug. We discussed the Commonwealth Club in San Fran, California, Monday, February 10th at noon. You'll be speaking and doing book signings. Anything else you want people to look up or check out?
Yeah, maybe, I don't know.
Who's in NPR?
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of great books. There are actually, you know, I could give you some of the lists of, you know, out of the 270, there are probably 12 or 13 that were really wonderful. And they're not necessarily ones that people know about.
Gotcha.
You know, like there's a Discovery of Witches by Deborah Harkness. Really wonderful. The Circle Trilogy, which is romance by, of all people, Nora Roberts. I didn't even believe. When I had never read a Nora Roberts novel, and I kept on thinking, Oh, she must have a stable of writers if she's written 250 novels in 30 years, and turned out she'd written them all herself, you know?
And just in case there was any confusion, I meant promote anything that you were trying to promote, any upcoming things or coming around town.
Oh, any upcoming things of mine.
For you, yeah,
well,
that's what I meant.
As I said, I'm going to California. I'm going to be at PantheaCon. I'm going to be talking at PantheaCon and signing books at PantheaCon and also at the Commonwealth Club. And who knows? I'm going to be – actually, tomorrow I'm going to be on Carolyn Casey's radio show, which is going to be really fun. Yeah, she does this visionary activist show, which is a really, really wild – you know, she's an astrologer and a lot of other things, and a really interesting person.
Would you be coming to D.C.?
Yes.
Oh, I have no idea. Someone
has
to invite me. But, you know, I have to come to D.C. because I haven't seen the new NPR. There's this huge new building that's, you know, it apparently looks like the Starship Enterprise, rumor has it. And I have not been there.
Legit.
Wow. Well, I'm going to go ahead here.
Yeah, people say it looks like you're on the bridge. But,
yeah,
you know,
some people refer to it as the mothership. For NPR.
That's really good. That's really funny. But I do want to go back to the thing that you mentioned that I didn't mention, but you mentioned it, and it really is the last line in my sermon, and it was also one of the last lines in my essay and everything, and it's basically that quote that I got out of a book by Victoria Nelson called Gothica, G-O-T-H-I-C-K-A, and it's at first I thought it was a Philip K. Dick quote, and then I looked all over the place and it wasn't. And it turned out she had sort of freely adapted her view of what Philip K. Dick would have said for this book. But it's just a great quote. And it's the one you were mentioning, when the divine has been exiled from popular culture for, you know, over 100 years, then, you know, the only place to really look for it is where elite culture, in the places elite culture calls the trash. And I really have come to believe that there's a lot of truth in that, that there's a kind of elitist view of what literature is and what a play is supposed to be and what poetry is supposed to be, and that, in fact, the genre, and when we're talking about vampire literature, we're talking about 50 different genres. We're talking about detective fiction and presidential vampire thrillers, and we're talking about alternate history and science fiction and vampirism as a disease and horror. And I mean, it goes on and on and on. There are literally probably 30 categories of books. And so if you've never tried any vampire novels, instead of going, oh, where shall I start, go to your favorite types of fiction, and you'll find something there.
Yeah,
okay, Mano, just real quick, do you think that, I think it's Bernie Madoff, do you think he was a vampire?
Well, certainly a financial vampire, no question about it. As a matter of fact, if you look at some of the writing that was done in 08 and 09 and whatever about the financial crisis, you will notice that a lot of people use vampire terminology. They talk about, we want the Glass-Steagall Act to give sunlight, you know, that would send the vampires scurrying. We want a stake in the heart of the, you know. I mean, you look around at some of that literature, and it's filled with references like that.
Now, we do have our reader on the line to do a brief, very brief tarot reading. Margo, if you would like.
Sure.
And here is Mr. Darren Bouquet.
Oh, okay. Yeah, thanks for unmuting me, because I had like a million things to say. So, Deborah Harkness, oh my gosh.
Extended the time a little bit.
Unbelievable. Two books so far. I just love that it's so academic, like, because of you know, being an enthusiast of alchemy and you know, the whole chemical marriage and everything like that. I just think it's fantastic. And what's your opinion on the Saint Germain series of books? Where have you gotten into that at all, Margo?
I've read three of them. I've read the one about Savonarola, you know, in the Medici's. I think that's a great book. I've read one of the ones that takes place with Caligula and all that in Rome. That's pretty incredible, pretty dark.
The Mayan one is pretty good, too, as well.
And then the first one, Hotel Transylvania, is a very good one.
Yeah, I thought those were fantastic. And then there's one, it's escaping me, but it's all about Lord Byron. There's one or two about Lord Byron.
Oh, there's several weird ones. There's this one called The Golden. And there's a whole bunch where Dracula comes back as a good guy. You know, Fred Saberhagen has written all these, you know, turn Dracula on its head. And there's a woman named Karen Essex, I believe is her name, and she's written a book that, again, turns Dracula on its head, and you realize that the real enemy is the male medical establishment that has basically messed up all these women.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Renaissance medicine was like almost as bad as medieval medicine.
Right. So there's some wonderful, and there's that incredible George R. R. Martin book called Fever Dream, which is an incredible vampire novel that takes place on the Mississippi River in the 19th century.
Oh wow! Well. Hey, I'm
there
living
are all
it right
kinds
now,
of
so.
Really you yeah. would, and then there are several thrillers. There's one called In Pursuit of Darkness, I think it's called, and basically there's a the vampire is a Karl Rove character, right before the 2012 election.
Wow, and just all this stuff. And I just wanted to comment on that because your statement about the work of the vampire fiction is as broad as any category in fiction. You know, it's just
exactly.
Look around.
Exactly. Well, it's like what Ursula K. Le Guin said about her book. She said, you know, my publishers call them speculative fiction or fantasy. Left to my own, I would call them novels.
Right. I mean, that's when I like to read for pleasure, I read something with a paranormal bent and a historical bent to it, or that integrates both. And sometimes
right.
I'll read, like, Rutherford or something that does, like, London and Paris and all that stuff. You know, and I might get into that, but, I mean, I can usually always find new fiction that has something supernatural incorporated with historical as well.
No, that's great. No, that stuff is great.
It's really fantastic. So if you wanted, we could just spend a minute and maybe just take a look at some of your energy a little bit and see what's
okay.
happening. If you wanted to.
All right.
Okay. So purple, green, or orange? And that's just going to relate to the deck I utilize.
Just choose?
Yes.
I choose
color.
One?
Yeah.
I always choose green.
Green, okay. All right. So I'm just going to take a general look at maybe what's coming up and what's happening. Does that sound okay?
Okay.
All right, well,
I happen to know a lot of what's happening.
Well, the people that call into the show, you know, they'll just say, can you just give me a general message? So, unless there's something you're particularly concerned about.
Oh, there is, but I'm not sure I'm going to say it here.
Oh, okay. All right. Oh, okay. Well, that's totally fine. I did have a talk with Daniel Michael about, you know, the reading. And that, so
right.
I'll let you know. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Take a look here for Margo.
Oh, okay.
Okay, there's a need for expansive time to quiet the soul and tranquility. I think that's something that you're kind of looking forward to, the nascence or birth of quiet and the exploration of kind of introspection. I think that you're burgeoning into a lot of really amazing social and networking sort of constructs, and you've done a lot of that, and what's coming up now is kind of this whole, like, kind of Elysian fields of kind of relaxing, contemplative energy, and I think you feel it kind of looming in your subconscious, and it's kind of getting a little bit closer, and I think it has this beautiful sort of nice sort of restful, peaceful sort of energy, okay? And I
wow.
think that's kind of on the horizon a little bit, and I think it has this wonderful meditative and contemplative energy. So I think that's coming, and I think that you can kind of feel that as a sense that's kind of bringing it a little bit closer. But hold on one moment. I want to get a couple cards on this as well. Okay. So just seeing, I'm getting the Knave of Wands. So this is someone that has a little bit of vibrant, thoughtful ideas about structures, constructs, and organizational focuses for the future for you. So this may be, I don't think it's necessarily a handler for you. It's like somebody more that has a personal vested interest that may do some of handle some of your networking and that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
But this is somebody that is in your personal circle. And this is somebody that has a vested interest in you maybe taking certain situations and that sort of thing. So this is a lot of positive, proactive, and structured energy that wants to kind of give you a nice balancing kind of a lean so that way you don't have to make some of the more pedantic or pedestrian decisions about, you know, like let's say, oh, do I want to go to that mom-and-pop bookstore and that sort of thing? Like, you know, maybe that's not exactly it. And I think that family time, actually bringing in some of the outlying family members that may have not integrated into your normal, like, day-to-day or month-to-month situation, I think some of them are going to pull back in to the energy through this person as well, too. So what we're seeing is kind of a renewal of some of the outlying family members and kind of pulling in of the web a little bit. Just a moment. Hold on. Oh, okay. All right. And I'm getting, okay. All right. I am getting the Wheel of Fortune inverted. Now, this is what I want to say about this. I think that it's time that maybe this the networking wheel kind of slow down a little bit, and it'll give you time to manifest something really amazing. And I want to say, and this is going to be totally complimentary, with drawing down the moon and what you, I mean, this is a mammoth elemental like endeavor when you decided to be the vessel for that. So I think that there's something else giantly, mammothly, elemental that's coming along, and that downtime, that like relaxed time. And so the Wheel of Fortune to me isn't anything bad. It's not necessarily bad luck or you know, it's something more of like that wheel of that networking thing kind of just slowing down a little bit, and then you're able to manifest that energy into something that's just going to be huge. Maybe have you been thinking at all about maybe Greco-Roman energy or anything like that?
Exactly. No. That's my next thought about Hellenic paganism. As I'm thinking about doing, that's exactly where I'm going.
It totally came.
That's exactly where I'm going, and I'm even thinking about doing research and writing a book on Hellenic paganism.
Oh my gosh! Wow. Okay. All right. Well, I think you definitely should do it because it came screaming out of you, like completely. You know, I got Demeter, I got all this, and you know, it was just like flying out of you. So,
wow,
I think it's going to be. I mean, if that's any validation, you know.
Oh wow, that's really exciting. Because it's really, I've been pondering about that, and I've been thinking, because the truth is that a lot of us got into the pagan movement because we got into the tradition that was in the neighborhood. And the neighborhood, for me, was the groups in the neighborhood were Welsh and Gardnerian Wicca. There was no Greco group.
Wow, how unusual.
But on the other hand,
that's always what it is.
Yes,
I mean,
but on the other hand, I ended up becoming a pagan because in my grammar school, we spent a whole year studying ancient Greece. And I kind of felt I had moved into my own homeland. So the truth is, you know, that would have been the tradition. I probably would have been a Hellenic Reconstructionist if things had worked out differently.
And if you think about the time period and the upswing of the Roman Empire, there were more temples to, you know, to Jove and Juno and all that, like than almost any other deity in history up to that point.
Right. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been to Pestum in Italy, but there are like three complete temples. They're better than anything you'll ever see in Greece. They are like incredible. And one
I would love to do that. Wow.
It's incredible. And when I was there, this is like 15 years ago, but when I was there, only German tourists were there. There was like no Americans. And it was the most incredible place.
Right, because, you know, you got to go to the Parthenon, you got to do all the, you know, obvious, not the Parthenon, but, you know.
Obvious
like
things, but yeah, things. But yeah, it was incredible. And, no, that is so funny that you said that. I mean, I'd be very interested at some point when the show is probably over, right? But I would love to at some point, you know, parse out that last part.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, we could definitely kind of dig into that a little bit. And I've seen that, you know, like the books on Aradia, like Raven Grimasi's and stuff, I mean, like they're not, there's not a lot of that out there. And Aradia is its own animal, but I mean,
right.
You know, even just like you said, Hellenic reconstructionist and like of the, you know, the ancient ways and that sort of thing, I think it would be amazing. Especially if if I can elaborate on it, I was getting a lot of the trans, you know, the winter to spring transitional myth and the whole idea of almost tying in Columbiana, the actual original goddess that was linked into America, and the whole idea of that she was also an Italian goddess of sorts, and this whole idea of the, you know.
Well, as I said, I don't know where it's going, but I definitely have gotten a message that it's what I am supposed to do next.
Well, that's amazing. I think that's going to be fantastic. So, you know, it was a real pleasure just meeting you on the air. It's fantastic.
It's been great. Absolutely terrific.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Thank you.
And that's Darren Bouquet. And we actually have gone over our hour, Margot.
Yes, we have.
but it seemed like everybody was having fun, so I just let her rip. And I want to thank Kevin and everybody else for calling in, who did, and for Darren. Now, Darren, were you calling actually from the shop?
Oh, no, I had a date.
Should have said yes.
Yes.
We wanted to picture you in the voodoo shop. That's kidding.
I was there all day. I actually brought a wonderful zombie voodoo doll home for my stepdaughter, and she was really enjoying.
Wow.
Ah.
Did she get
missing an arm and a whole head gashed open. That's pretty cute.
It's a zombie one. Anyway, everybody, we're listening to Main Street Universe. I'm Daniel Michael, and this is Janice R. White.
Hello.
And we have been talking to Margot Adler and discussing her book Vampires Are Us, and now we do have about 22 minutes left, but we've kind of gone over your hour, and I want to respect your time, Margot. If you think you have a few minutes left, that's fine. If not, we'll go ahead and sign out. Leave that up to you.
I think I'm going to go to bed.
Right.
Okay. Very important.
I generally have this tendency to wake up really early, like 5.
Oh yeah,
I live completely opposite to vampire hours.
That's right. That's what I was going to say. They don't sound like vampire hours, do they?
No,
yeah, no.
No,
so. I guess I don't. I don't really get the vampire hours and stuff. But let me just think if there's anything else that I want to say about this whole vampire thing that I haven't said. There's probably a lot, but Let's see. I guess I would say that I do think that it's fascinating that Stuart Brand had that vision in 68 and he put those buttons up and then he wrote the Whole Earth Catalog and then he basically created the first Earth Day, you know, and here we are.
Absolutely.
Very.
All right. Yeah. Well, thank you very
much. All
right. Much.
Take care and blessed be.
Absolutely. Take care and blessed be to you as well. Everybody, you've
blessed
been listening to Main Street Universe, the show and network reminding you that the mysteries and possibilities of the universe are closer to Main Street than you may have ever
imagined. And I can imagine a lot.
Have a great evening, everyone. Wear garlic.
Forbidden archaeology. Forgotten history. Divination. Magic, cryptozoology, UFOs, nature, science,
and spirit. All this and more right here on the Main Street Universe Radio Network.